Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The immediate past Speaker of the Florida House has a new job. Meet Richard Corcoran, Florida Commissioner of Education.
School choice, I have no problem with that, but we do need an equal level playing field.
Also this week, come January, more than a million new people will be eligible to vote in Florida. Whether or not they'll be allowed to register to vote right away is still an unanswered question.
All of the supervisor of elections are going to do their job, taking the application, scanning it in, and sending it to the state. What the state is going to do, the state has no clue yet.
We'll also learn that full recovery from Hurricane Michael is a process that is likely to take many months, if not years, and we'll discover the state is losing out on millions of dollars in movie-making money. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. For nearly a week, the rumors had been swirling around Tallahassee. The state's top educator was going to be someone very familiar around the Capitol. But when the official word came, it still generated more than a few shockwaves. Governor-elect Ron DeSantis has chosen fellow Republican and former Florida House Speaker Richard Corcoran to head the State Department of Education. Ryan Daly reports Florida's Board of Education will vote on whether or not Corcoran gets the job later this month.
As the board prepares to vote in the next commissioner of education, strong opinions of support and resistance surround Corcoran's appointment. Governor-elect DeSantis this week announced his education transition team. It features Erica Donalds, a former Collier County school board member. A proponent of school choice, Donalds is one of those in Corcoran's corner who says Corcoran will bring needed change.
Richard Corcoran is, as Ron DeSantis said in his release yesterday, a no-nonsense reformer. He does not give deference to the current system. His sole priority is what is best for children and students and their families and how to get them the best educational options that are going to meet their needs.
Donalds points to Corcoran's leadership style and outlining why she feels he can get the job done.
I believe that Richard is looking forward to ultimately what is the right education system that is going to benefit all students. And then he's going to map out a plan for us to get there and what needs to be changed, adjusted, improved, eliminated in order for us to meet the needs of every single student.
Some public education advocates around the state have been sounding off with a decidedly different tone. The League of Women Voters is petitioning the state board to perform a national search for the new commissioner, writing the board has a constitutional responsibility to do so. Frederick Ingram is president of the statewide teachers union, the Florida Education Association. For the same reasons choice proponents laud Corcoran as the right pick, Ingram says he would be of detriment to public education.
Richard Corcoran has been one of those people who has squarely put it in his sights to advance the position of charter schools and vouchers and things that promote something other than what we know as public education.
Ingram cites massive education bills passed in the last two legislative sessions under Corcoran's leadership that he says changed things for the worse.
Under his tenure, 70-69, the biggest expansion of charter schools that we've seen in the state of Florida's history. This is not a person who has been public education friendly. This is not a person who wants to see good public schools expanded. In a way that is going to be, that is going to mean success for our kids.
Ingram is among those calling for a nationwide search for candidates. Democratic Senator Bill Monfort has been a voice in Florida education for decades and currently helms the state's Association of District School Superintendents. His approach to a potential Commissioner Corcoran sounds more like cautious optimism.
It's clear that under his administration as Speaker, where his priorities were, and that's school choice. I have no problem with that. But we do need an equal level playing field.
Monfort says he understands the viewpoints of those like Ingram who feel traditional public schools are under attack.
That many of us supported charter schools. This was 1996. The idea was for a charter school to go into a struggling school where the traditional approach has not worked. I said, that's fine. If we can find somebody in a group and different ideas, less restrictions, if that'll work, that's fine. However, what it has turned into in many cases is a money-making proposition, and that's not what those of us back in the 90s supported.
Monford doesn't voice opposition to Corcoran taking the post. The senator says he just wants traditional public and charter schools to play by the same set of rules.
If the speaker turns out to be our commissioner, then we are asked that he treat traditional public schools as well as we have in the past with charter schools and other schools.
The State Board of Education will vote on Corcoran's recommendation December 17th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Select felons who have completed their sentence will be eligible to vote come January 8th. At least that's what the state's voters approved when they overwhelmingly passed Amendment 4 back in November. As Blaise Ganey reports, elections officials met this week to discuss how to add the roughly 1.5 million extra voters to the list.
On December 4th, when officials from the Division of Elections met with supervisors from Florida's 67 counties in Sarasota, they faced several questions on if or when their registration process would change. Ion Sancho, former Leon County Supervisor of Election, says the county supervisor's procedure shouldn't change.
So on January 8th, all the supervisor of elections across the state, that's when the amendment goes into effect, January 8th, individuals may fill out a voter registration application and register to vote. And the county supervisor of elections will accept those applications. That's step one.
Florida clemency lawyer Reggie Garcia believes their process should be similar to registration for non-felons.
So arguably, Amendment 4, as big as it is potentially for the 1.7 million convicted felons, and remember there was an exclusion for murder and sex offenses, number one, people have to complete their term of sentence. And number two, they have to complete Form 39 or whatever its successor is and turn that in January 8th, 2019 or thereafter when Amendment 4 is effective.
But some state officials have other ideas. State's top election official, Secretary of State Ken Dessner, says he believes the legislature should provide guidance. Meanwhile, Garcia believes the opposite.
Because the constitutional amendment uses the word shall twice after the completion of sentence, I think it's less open to interpretation and more likely to be self-executing.
But some worry the implementation of the bill could be slow-walked because of politics. Sancho pointed to the election's aftermath as an example.
For example, in the recent controversies with the actual governor making these outlandish statements about fraud and ballots nowhere, which basically was refuted by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement themselves.
Community advocate Neil Voles, who is also a felon, says he and others are hopeful politics will not delay the will of the voters.
Well, we're hopeful that we can walk this out together. We believe people when they say that they want to adhere to the will of the public who overwhelmingly supported Amendment 4 and said very clearly that, you know, when a debt's paid, it's paid. And when somebody's paid all portions of their debt back, they can be eligible to vote.
Ultimately, Neil says he expects no matter what happens, January 8th will be a celebrated day.
In some communities, there are going to be people who get in buses and go together. In other communities, people are going to, you know, meet at supervisors of elections offices. In other communities, it's going to be sharing your story on social media and Facebook Live, or, you know, just making sure that this is something that we can all celebrate together.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Blaise Ganey.
Today, Governor Rick Scott announced the launch of two Visit Florida Hurricane Michael assistance programs. They're supposed to aid local tourism businesses in the counties that were included in the FEMA Major Disaster Declaration back on October 11th. The Tourism Recovery Grant Program for Hurricane Michael and Hurricane Michael Recovery Marketing Program are available to Bay, Calhoun, Franklin, Gadsden, Gulf, Holmes, Jackson, Leon, Liberty, Taylor, Wakulla, and Washington counties. They're designed to help the areas to market their charter destinations once hurricane-damaged areas are open to visitors. The announcement of these Hurricane Michael assistance programs follows a nearly $9 million marketing plan that was developed and launched by Visit Florida in late October. The extensive multi-phase campaign includes more than $5 million to support the panhandle following the storm and marketing efforts such as digital, social, broadcast, and traditional components in both domestic and international visitor markets. Still to come on Capitol Report, the start of the next legislative session is months away, but already Florida lawmakers are fighting over who should control concealed weapons permits.
All it does is it loudly shouts that this is something that they want it to remain political.
The storm recovery effort continues in North Florida 2 full months after the region was ravaged by Hurricane Michael.
There's still a lot that needs to occur to help people regain their lives.
The beating the Florida timber industry took during the storm is leading to a bruised economy as people worry about losing jobs and even their retirement funds.
80% of our income around here is timber driven, whether logging for the mills or chipping for fuel.
And a new report finds Florida should consider reviving film and TV tax incentives.
An average feature film can spend between $250,000 and $300,000 a day in a local community.
Lawmakers and gun rights advocates are squabbling over who should have control of Florida's concealed weapons permits. Internal reports from the Agriculture Department and an official review have highlighted problems with the current system. Sean Mulcahy reports.
The state agriculture commissioner is currently in charge of processing concealed weapon permit requests. Commissioner Adam Putnam, a self-described proud NRA sellout, has greatly expanded the program under his leadership. Coupled with recent mass shootings, Putnam's office saw a huge spike in applications, but the influx proved too much for the office to handle. In June, the Tampa Bay Times reported that for more than a year, the state failed to run requests through a national background check database. After reviewing the applications processed during that time, Putnam's office retroactively revoked 310 permits. This week, the Times discovered errors were more widespread than previously thought. An Auditor General's report found Putnam didn't disclose information to investigators, gave false information to the public, and approved more erroneous licenses even after the problem was discovered. And to incoming Agriculture Commissioner Democrat Nikki Fried, that's a big problem.
We need to do an audit of the department and figure out exactly what happened, why somebody was able to not log in for 13 months. Whether that could happen again, we need to make sure that those holes are plugged.
Fried campaigned on pushing for more gun regulations and on checking the power of the state's concealed weapons permit system. Part of the solution, she says, is moving permitting to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement.
Law enforcement is already so instrumental in the process, and that way you get politics out of this. You know, we saw after the primary that over 300 emails were released between the Department of Agriculture and the NRA lobbyists, where she had direct influence over policies that were coming out of the Department of Agriculture.
The legislature is poised to do just that. Two Democratic senators have filed a bill that would move oversight of concealed weapons permits to FDLE.
They are the ones who can truly understand the aftermath of weapons getting into the hands of those who should not have them, and they are supposed to and do manage and uphold the law.
That's Plantation Democrat Senator Lauren Book. She's the bill's sponsor. But Florida NRA lobbyist Marion Hammer wants control of the program moved to Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Patronis. She told the Times an elected official should oversee the program. Orlando Democratic Senator Linda Stewart calls this a Republican power grab.
When is the Nikki Fried, the person who was recently elected, is a Democrat, that's who would normally take over this responsibility. Now she wants it put into another cabinet member who is a Republican that cries and shouts out partisanship.
Meanwhile, Agriculture Commissioner Putnam has defended his department, but he's largely remained silent about changes to the program.
Well, there's a lot of opinions about where to move it to, if they move it at all, and I'll let the legislature sort that out.
The Democratic bill faces an uphill battle. The Senate Judiciary Committee, which oversees gun legislation, is chaired by Republican Senator David Simmons. And Republican Senators Kelly Stargell and Dennis Baxley also sit on the committee. The three are staunch Second Amendment supporters. But Senator Book is confident the evidence speaks for itself.
The fact facts are what the facts are. The Department of Agriculture under Adam Putnam once allowed a 5% error rate for employees who process concealed carry background checks. That wouldn't fly under FDLE oversight.
Book says it's not about limiting access to guns. It's about keeping them out of the hands of dangerous people. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sean Mulcahy.
Two months after Hurricane Michael slammed into North Florida, leveling communities from the coast to South Georgia, areas continue the struggle to get back up and running. The Rebuild 850 campaign is trying to keep that recovery in the forefront to make sure the area often known as the Forgotten Coast isn't this time. Lynn Hatter has that story.
The moving company AmWatt has one of its trucks parked outside the Tallahassee Democrat's South Magnolia office. A pile of toys is steadily growing as cars drive up to drop off more.
Okay. And then Volunteer Florida Foundation is going to be the entity that's going to distribute.
Gloria Pugh is one of the company's owners. These toys will eventually head west and be distributed to families impacted by Hurricane Michael. The toy drive is part of ongoing efforts by Rebuild 850, the organization created in the wake of the storm to keep attention on the needs of the panhandle after Hurricane Michael. The storm hit the state 2 months ago. Former North Florida Congresswoman Gwen Graham co-founded the group, and she was recently in Panama City.
Though the hurricane hit 2 months ago, you still see the devastation everywhere that you go, and so there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and that's why I'm so honored to be a part of Rebuild 850, because we need to keep the attention on North Florida and have people know that there's still a lot that needs to occur to help people regain their lives.
Meanwhile, most school districts hit hard by the storm were able to reopen just last month. And North Florida Senator Bill Monford says students and staff continue to grapple with a new reality.
But there's a tremendous impact on these young people. And that's why the whole mental health issue for our children, especially children, can't go unnoticed. We've got to recognize that there will be severe emotional issues with the children and the teachers.
The level of destruction from the Category 4 hurricane is comparable to that of Hurricane Andrew, Graham says. Estimates put claims at around $4.5 billion and growing.
You'll see on people's doors, not open, but we will rebuild. And so there is a spirit. When I ran for Congress in 2014, I called it the North Florida Way. There is that spirit of the North Florida Way where people are going to come together and help one another to get our lives back. And though Tallahassee, we were very fortunate because we were on the eastern edge of the storm. If you get in your car and you drive west, you'll see how people are still really suffering. And we need to make sure that we keep our neighbors in the panhandle in our minds and in our hearts and help them with the resources they need. Go over to Panama City and go to the beach. I mean, make sure that we're investing in this part of Florida that desperately at this time needs our help.
I'm Lynn Hatter.
Hurricane Michael did more than $1 billion in damage to the state's forestry industry. As Regan McCarthy tells us, some worry that means a loss of jobs, loss of business, and loss of income for many North Florida families.
Tallahassee Democratic Senator Bill Monford says the damage done to the timber industry will have long-ranging and far-reaching impacts.
There are many, many people of age and about to be of age, that means retirement, that had maybe a small stand of timber they were depending on to supplement their Social Security.
But Monford says Hurricane Michael has changed that.
If you go throughout North Florida, in the affected areas, you will see acres and acres for miles and miles and miles of timber just completely wiped out. It was as though this was a 150-mile-wide tornado. And these people now have lost a significant portion of their retirement income.
Monford says that's especially concerning in a largely rural and low-income area where people are already stretched trying to make ends meet following the storm.
Some of the highest levels of poverty per capita exist in the counties and the cities and the communities that have been impacted. It is not unusual to see many of the same families trying to live in one house because the other houses have been destroyed.
Montford says he spoke with one family following the storm who'd moved into a relative's house after their home was destroyed. So many people had doubled up that 17 adults were living under that one roof. And some say they're not hopeful situations like that will change anytime soon.
80% of our income around here is timber driven, whether logging for the mills or chipping for the fuel.
That's Steve Bailey, a former Blountstown City Council member. He says the widespread loss of timber could mean local mills will be forced to close.
They're talking about pulling the mills out now because for the next 30 years they will have no wood here. There's not a planted pine in probably 50 miles from here that's not laying over.
Bailey says he's heard of timber workers who've been forced to move because they can't find work in the area. Meanwhile, Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam says there's a rush to make the most of the wood that came down before it suffers too much damage.
To put it in perspective, we estimate that there's roughly an equivalent of 2.5 million truckloads of timber laying on the ground. It could be as much as a 20-year supply of wood laying there. And you've got, you know, somewhere around 6 to 9 months before the bugs move in to move that timber to market. The biggest mill is down in Panama City. So it's a real long-term challenge. You're going to flood the market now. The prices have crashed.
Putnam says the state is asking the federal government for help getting timberland cleaned up and replanted. But without that assistance, he says rural parts of North Florida are likely facing a long-term economic crisis. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
A St. Augustine state senator has filed a proposal to require high school students to take financial literacy classes. We get that story from Brendan Rivers at member station WJCT in Jacksonville.
Republican Travis Hudson filed the Dorothy Huckel Financial Literacy Act last week in honor of his colleague who died this year. Under the measure, students going into ninth grade starting next fall will be required to take a class in personal financial literacy and money management. Topics would include balancing checkbooks, completing loan applications, and calculating interest rates. Hudson says teachers love the idea.
The one concern is you're taking out a half of an elective and making a mandate or a requirement. Some of them want it to be more optional, but it's not something Dorothy believed in. It's not something I believe in. I think that everybody should go through this.
Hudson says he and Huckel were good friends and office neighbors. He and the Port Orange Republican also sat next to each other on the Senate floor. Huckel died in October after battling with cervical cancer.
It was a tough time hearing about her and tough time going to share the stories and memories with the family. But we're trying to move on and hopefully get this done, and it'll be a pretty emotional day should it pass both chambers.
Hudson says he's optimistic because Huckel's version of the bill passed the Senate unanimously during the last legislative session. Republican Representative Elizabeth Fetterhoff, Huckel's former aide, has filed the House version. I'm Brendan Rivers in Jacksonville.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida's share of film and TV productions is waning as the state no longer offers tax credits for the industry. A new analysis finds Florida lawmakers may have good reason to reconsider those incentives. Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan tells us the report suggests Florida will have to step up if it wants to compete for billions of show business dollars.
Am I crazy? Are their palm trees greener than ours?
They're just thirstier.
The HBO series Ballers, starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson, was filmed in South Florida for its first two seasons. Then it moved to California after Florida's film tax credit program ended in 2016. The show is still going strong, now working on its fifth season.
Nobody go anywhere. We're going to war.
Ballers employed more than 2,800 people in Florida, spent over $20 million each season in the South Florida area, and literally picked up and took those jobs and those dollars elsewhere.
John Lux is executive director of Film Florida, a not-for-profit, membership-based trade association. He's tired of Florida losing out on productions, especially those that pass off other states as the Sunshine State.
It is gut-wrenching every time we see something portrayed as Florida, and it's not.
Lux says in the last 4 years, more than 60 major projects chose not to come to Florida or decided to leave, equaling a loss of more than $1 billion for local economies.
We bring in mobile homes. We bring in porta potties. We bring in tent companies. Off-duty police officers and security guards work on those sets. Plumbers, electricians, caterers, dry cleaners, food trucks. You know, an average feature film can spend between $250,000 and $300,000 a day in a local community. Television series, about $150,000 to $200,000 a day.
Lux says Florida's great weather and scenery aren't enough to compete. Take Georgia's incentives package, for example. It includes a 20% tax credit for companies that spend at least $500,000 on film projects. An additional 10% is granted if the finished product includes a promotional logo provided by the state. And the program is thriving. Between 2016 and 2017, Georgia was home to more than 100 films and 150 TV series, which paid out more than $2 billion in wages.
Through a combination of the loss of the incentive programs and efforts by other states to offer more incentives to production, Florida's kind of fallen behind.
Bob Nave is lead author of the report, which was paid for in part by Film Florida. Nave is vice president of research for Florida Tax Watch, described as an independent, nonprofit government watchdog.
There are opportunities to retool and relaunch an incentive program that would generate a very high economic impact, a very high return on the investment, and help restore our film industry.
Part of the problem with the previous program, Nave says, is that productions were awarded on a first-come, first-served basis until no more credits were available. Instead, he says the state should consider each production's potential return on investment when determining who should get a tax break.
I think the state would have to develop an incentive program that awarded incentives based on the number of days that a production company was going to film in Florida, the number of Floridians that would be hired as part of the crew or cast, the number of nights hotel rooms are rented, the number of rental cars rented. So all of these things would be rolled into an economic impact. You compare that to how much you're investing and you generate a return.
During the final year of Florida's tax cut program in 2016, the report found the film and television industry was responsible for more than 150,000 jobs and $2 billion in wages in Florida. But Nave says the return on investment was too low for Florida lawmakers to consider extending the tax credit program. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Gina Jordan.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaze Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol. Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.